Which party is responsible for Ebola? Which candidate will come in third in South Dakota? And which city may return a convicted felon to the mayoralty? From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 47 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. We're surprised, but we shouldn't be. Candidates are pointing fingers at each other over who's responsible for Ebola. As if you needed another example of how politics can make you sick. We'll talk about how the disease has become a political football this election season. Then we succumb to peer pressure and visit the South Dakota Senate race. Long thought to be a sure GOP pickup, it's now getting closer, with a name from the state's past complicating things for both Republicans and Democrats. A guy who served 21 years as mayor of Providence, Rhode Island, and 4 years in federal prison for corruption, is back on the stump and could win. We'll talk about Buddy Cianci's attempted comeback. And we go back to that horrible time of October 2000, when the governor of Missouri was locked in a tight battle for the U.S. Senate, only to perish in a plane crash shortly before the election. We remember Mel Carnahan. But first, this week's trivia question. Larry Presser is running for the Senate in South Dakota this year. 18 years ago, he was defeated for re-election to his Senate seat. Who was the last senator to lose his bid for re-election in November and then come back in a later cycle and return to the Senate? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And there's no need to ever wait again for the weekly trivia question. Hop over to the Political Junkie page on Facebook. We post the trivia question for fans only every Wednesday. And there's other great stuff on the page, too. That's the Political Junkie on Facebook. We're the one with the button. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stick around. A lot of issues that we thought would play a big role in the 2014 elections, like the botched rollout of the Affordable Care Act, or the Keystone Pipeline, or the government shutdown, have mostly faded in the background. Even the conflicts in Ukraine, Syria, and Iraq have had limited impact. One foreign policy issue that's getting a lot of play is Ebola. Mind you, no candidate is for Ebola. In fact, nearly everyone I've heard from seems to be against it. But with the election less than 3 weeks away, it's become the latest opportunity for playing the blame game. Democrats are doing most of the finger-pointing. They argue Republican-led budget cuts hurt the government's ability to fight the disease. But Republicans are playing the game, too. They say if we don't tighten the border with Mexico, who knows what and who can get into this country. Aaron Blake's been following this from his perch at the Washington Post. Aaron, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Thank you for having me, Ken.
It's a campaign where apparently, and I mean anything goes, so maybe we shouldn't be surprised by what we've seen, but maybe a little disheartened.
Look, this was kind of a perfect storm for making Ebola an issue in this election. First of all, we've got just kind of a lack of other issues to talk about. This is really the election about nothing in a lot of ways.
The Seinfeld election, they're calling it, right?
Yeah, the Seinfeld election. There's not really kind of one overarching theme that has dominated this race from the start and really defined it. And so Ebola kind of came along at a really interesting time when we were filling a vacuum, so to speak, and giving candidates something to talk about. It also happens to be, as for the second point, something that is a very scary thing for people. You know, people are very scared about terrorism, of course, but Ebola is much more mysterious to them. It's a much more irresistible topic. And so it's not surprising to see candidates try to latch onto this in some way, shape, or form.
The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee launched a web ad that said the Republicans voted to cut the CDC's budget to fight Ebola. Then a group called the Agenda Project went even further. In its ad, along with a speech from CDC Director Thomas Frieden, are sound bites from Republicans saying cut, 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 cut. All the candidates were saying that, though we really don't know exactly what they're in favor of cutting. Let's hear part of the ad.
Cut.
There are outbreaks happening today that we're not able to recognize, stop, or prevent as effectively as we should be able to.
Cut.
Make a cut.
Then you see a slew of dead bodies, presumably in West Africa. Then there's a tagline, Republican cuts kill. I've seen negative ads, but this one seems to be way over the top.
Yeah, and that's really this group's MO. This is the same group you might recall during the 2012 presidential race that ran the ad in which a guy who looked a whole lot like Paul Ryan was taking Granny to the edge of a cliff and throwing her off the cliff. So the subtlety is not their stock in trade. And I would also point out that this ad probably doesn't have very much money behind it if it's even running on TV. But, you know, I think that Democrats are certainly trying this out as an argument. Our fact checker did not find that this was a particularly credible argument. They pointed out that the Obama administration has also included cuts to NIH that would affect this kind of research before. So, you know, people will do what they can to kind of get a political edge on an issue. But I don't think that the dots are necessarily connected at this point. And quite frankly, for as much as we're talking about this issue, our new Washington Post ABC poll only shows 20% of people say that they are very worried about Ebola. So I'm not sure this is a huge voting issue just yet, but we still have 3 weeks, of course.
Now, on the other side, you have Republicans calling for a ban on flights from West Africa. You have others like Ted Cruz, who are suggesting that because Obama hasn't done the job sealing the border with Mexico, there's a potential for more people with Ebola coming into the country. I mean, that may not be as outrageous as the previous ad we just heard, but it still deserves to be truth squatted.
Look, yeah, and anytime people are concerned about something, there's a whole bunch of what ifs, and if that what if sounds even a little bit plausible to somebody, they're going to want to jump on board with that. I would note that our new Washington Post ABC News poll shows 2/3 of people agree with some kind of a flight restriction from those countries in West Africa that are dealing with the Ebola situation. So this is something of a politically resonant position, and that's why we're seeing some people like Perry. Bobby Jindal's been talking about this. It's been somewhat of an issue in the North Carolina Senate race, where the Republican is asking for Senator Kay Hagan, the Democrat, to jump on board with some of these flight restrictions, and has really been kind of pressuring her to do that for a number of days. So this cuts both ways. Right now, obviously, we're in a situation where this is not an outbreak at this point. We are not talking about a bunch of Americans dying. There have been 2 cases of people in America coming down with Ebola. But that's not going to prevent people from worrying about the worst case scenario. And I guess when it comes to things like this, you have to worry about the worst case scenario.
Well, I think you make a very good point there. I mean, yes, the patient did die in Texas, and the nurse treating him was infected herself, even though she was wearing all the required protective gear. But that plays into the entire narrative, doesn't it? Like that things are not working. You have Ebola, you have the Secret Service, you have ISIS. People are worried. The government is incompetent in this argument, and the party in charge, the Democrats, are to blame. Either way, I mean, that seems to be a campaign issue.
That's right. I mean, things always are not that bad until they are. You know, people were told that the Ebola virus was not easily transmissible. And then the nurse who was supposedly supposed to take all these precautions that would prevent her from becoming infected became infected. And of course, there was all kinds of rumor and innuendo which ensued from that, which much of which was very irresponsible. But, you know, I think that this country, in a lot of ways, was founded on skepticism of a big central government and what that government is telling you. And that persists until today. So you can tell the American people as much as you want that the Ebola virus is not easily transmissible. There will not be an outbreak. This is a very limited situation. But there's also a healthy skepticism that I think a lot of people will continue to have with something like this. And that feeds into making it a political issue, I think.
As long as I have you, and I do have you, there are less than 3 weeks to go. Let's look at the big picture for a second. Sometimes it's just funny to read which way the campaign is going. The Republicans are up, they're down, the Democrats are coming back, they're finished. I mean, you and I read the same things. How does the battle for the Senate stand right now in your view?
Look, I think Republicans have been favored for a while now. Now, they have been favored to varying degrees for a while now. Sometimes it looks more certain than others. I think that right now it looks more certain than it generally has. Republicans have those six red states that they're very much counting on winning. You've got West Virginia, Montana, South Dakota. Those are seen as the most likely. Then Mary Landrieu in Louisiana, Mark Pryor in Arkansas, Mark Begich in Alaska, those three incumbents that they're counting on beating. They win those six seats and hold their ground. They're in the majority. They also happen to have very good pickup opportunities in Iowa and Colorado, where most of the recent polling shows them ahead, albeit within the margin of error. And then they're defending, obviously, a state like Kansas, where they would rather not be defending right now, and it's really complicated things. But I think that given the amount of opportunities that are on the board, even if they lost a state like Kansas somehow because Pat Roberts really messed up, they'd still have a really good shot at winning the majority. I think the biggest X factor here in potentially changing the game is if Democrats can somehow put Georgia into play. I don't think it's looking as far-fetched as it was a few weeks ago. The Democrats got a really good hit on David Perdue from some of his past comments about outsourcing. If they can add that really good second pickup opportunity, which I would argue they haven't had for a number of months now, I think that they can really complicate the math and kind of throw this one up in the air a little bit.
3 weeks out, if you had a dollar in your wallet, would you bet that dollar on the Republicans taking the Senate?
You know, I would if I were a betting man. I think that's where almost everybody has the odds right now. But the other thing that I would say is that the Republican Party, at least early on in the 2010 election cycle and early on in the 2012 election cycle, a lot of people thought they had a really good chance to win the Senate then. And then certain things happen. Now, those kinds of things haven't happened so far this cycle. 3 weeks ago, I think they have done a good job of avoiding their Todd Akin moments and things like that. But there are still 3 weeks left. The media coverage of these guys is increasing. Certain things always come out at the last moment. We always have that kind of last October surprise. So stay tuned. But for now, Republicans are favored.
Aaron Blake covers politics for The Washington Post. He can be found on Twitter at AaronBlakeWP. Aaron, thanks again for being on the show again.
Thank you, Ken. Good to be with you.
Welcome back to The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. This campaign season has us doing a lot of double takes. Kansas, Iowa, never on anybody's watch list. Now it's South Dakota. Senator Tim Johnson, the three-term Democrat, is retiring. Mike Rounds, the Republican former governor, was going to succeed him. Plain and simple. A blowout. Case closed. That may no longer be the case. The first sign that something was up came when the Democratic Senatorial Committee announced it was putting $1 million into the race. That raised a lot of eyebrows. Then a poll showed Rounds still in the lead, but just narrowly, with 35% of the vote. Larry Pressler, the independent candidate and former senator, was second with 32%, and Rick Wyland, the Democratic nominee, had 28%, certainly too close to call. Whatever you think of the poll or how it was conducted, it woke up the two major parties and the political media. I'm hoping Jonathan Ellis can help us, because this one's a real head-scratcher. Jonathan is a reporter with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader and has been covering the race. Jonathan, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ken.
Let me think of an elegant way how to ask this. What the heck is going on?
You know, your intro kind of captures it. I mean, Mike Rounds won the Republican primary in early June with about 56% of the race in a five-way race. So it came out on top. He was expected to come out on top. And then has sort of, over the last few months, just kind of trailed off. I mean, he hasn't run a very inspiring campaign. It's just been sort of a generic campaign. Many political insiders here are simply appalled at his advertising. It's just been, in their words, very amateurish. And in the meantime, he's been targeted very aggressively by the state Democratic Party first, some outside groups, political action committees more recently, on his role in the EB-5 Immigrant Investor Program, which is a sort of national program in which immigrants who invest a minimum of about $500,000 and create 10 jobs and qualifying economic development projects can receive visas. There's a scandal involving that, and his political opponents have done their best to sort of tie him to that anchor.
Is it fair to tie him to that anchor? Did Rounds have a role in that immigrant scandal?
Well, certainly, to go into what detail, I mean, there was one project in particular. There were a number of projects that were funded in South Dakota through this mechanism. One project in particular, however, was a high-profile beef plant that is now bankrupt. And shortly after he left office, Rounds' cabinet secretary for economic development, Richard Benda, departed and went to work for a company that oversaw these EB-5 loans. In addition, about $550,000 of state money that was going to this northern beef plant as a tax incentive was then transferred to the company that the former cabinet secretary, Richard Benda, was going to work for. So there was this specter of state money being used to pay off a former cabinet secretary who went to work in the private sector. So you have this sort of, you know, it leads somebody to make accusations of crony capitalism. You know, amid an investigation, there's been some criminal investigations in all of this. The cabinet secretary, Richard Bennett, committed suicide about a year ago. And so there, you know, it's just been sort of an unraveling of what's been going on, what's been happening, and what was Rounds' role. I mean, Rounds was a champion of the program, no doubt about it. Brought a lot of money into the state. I mean, there have been some attempts to actually, you know, link him to some of this stolen state money. I mean, there's just absolutely no evidence of that. But there certainly, he was the, you know, chief executive of the state and a champion of the program, and some money, you know, in theory, got misused.
Well, actually, Round, for his part, I mean, Round says it's much ado about nothing. Let's listen to one of his ads.
I was having a cup of coffee with my dad, Grandpa Don. He asked me, "Mike, what's with all the negative advertising these guys are using against you?" I said, "Dad, they just don't want to talk about the issues. This is all they've got. We want to talk about fixing the bureaucratic nightmare in Washington, D.C. We want to talk about fixing the budget and passing a budget every single year. We know that we have to repeal and replace Obamacare. And we know that we have to fix Medicare. Because if we don't, well, that's not good for seniors in South Dakota."
Well, that's his response. That sounds like an interesting response, shall we say.
Well, I was critical of that response in a column that I wrote recently regarding this race. I mean, you know, one thing about Mike Rounds is he's never run a negative campaign. He was elected to governor in 2002. He was one of three Republicans in the primary that year, and the two top Republicans just tore each other apart in some of the just most outlandish political ads that the state has ever seen. And Mike Rounds sort of was the third man standing, and voters voted him in. He won that Republican primary, which in South Dakota, if you win the Republican primary, that's the hard part. There's this mythology that about Rounds that he's Smiling Mike, and he doesn't run negative campaigns. And as you can tell, I mean, that's his reaction to that piece that you ran is his reaction to some ads that have been tearing him up. My critique and the critique of a lot of other political insiders is, well, I mean, we're talking about a U.S. Senate race here. This is the big time, and you have to play on that level if you're going to run for U.S. Senate, and so far.
Right. So it's more than Grandpa Don, right?
Right. Right. It's more than Grandpa Don. And now we've seen, you said that the DSCC is playing here with about $1 million. Prior to them getting involved, you know, I think they got involved shortly after a couple of Democratic-leaning PACs. Each, I think, promised a couple $1 million. So, you know, instantaneously overnight, you had about $3 million in a small media state like ours. That can buy a lot of media, $3 million of hostile money. And we haven't touched on this, but Mike Rounds really didn't raise enough money to defend himself. You know, because, as you pointed out, this was supposed to be a sort of a blowout for Republicans. The contention from the Rounds people is that, well, it was very difficult to raise money because all the money was going to more competitive races. Some people would say that that's not a great argument. I mean, donors like to donate money to people that are going to win Senate seats, too. So, you know, there's a thought among a lot of, you know, these national Republicans that Rounds just didn't do enough this summer after securing the nomination to defend himself from, you know, these ravenous super PACs that are roaming around out there looking for races.
The guy who's turned this race around is, we haven't even mentioned his name yet, and that's Larry Pressler. Remind us who he was and and who he is. I mean, he hasn't been in South Dakota much lately, has he? Or at least until this election.
No, Larry Pressler just sort of showed up again. Generally, I think he spends most of his time in Washington. He served South Dakota starting in 1974. He won his first House seat, and then in 78 won his first of three U.S. Senate races, the same seat that's in play now, incidentally. So he lost in 1996 in a very bitter race to Tim Johnson, who, as you noted, is now retiring. So Larry Pressler is back, is running as an independent. Been obviously gone now for 18 years, but you know, he was around a lot. His name still carries a lot of weight. He won a lot of elections here. And for maybe some people, particularly some Republicans or independents who are a little off put by this EB-5 thing we talked about, which again, not a lot of people understand that EB-5, it's a very complex issue, but it just, to a lot of voters, I think just doesn't feel right. And, you know, something's wrong there. And so I think Larry Pressler has been sort of a safe harbor for some Republicans. And some independents, and frankly, he's also been a place where he's received Democratic support as well from Democrats who are probably a little more left of center versus as liberal as their nominee is, Rick Wyland. So I think that some moderate Democrats have also been in Larry's camp.
Well, I was going to say, you're talking about perhaps disaffected Republicans might lean towards Pressler, but Pressler has twice endorsed Barack Obama for president. I mean, doesn't sound like the kind of Republican he was when he was in Congress.
No, Larry, his success in South Dakota politics, he always needed to have some Democratic votes. So he always, he was not a good Republican trooper, I think you would say, in his time in Congress, because he would do things that would anger, I think, Republican leaders, because he would go off and do his own thing. So he has, typically he's relied on some Democratic support here. But you're right, the support for Barack Obama, he's also been high profile on his support for same-sex marriage. He'll say that, well, I support Barack Obama because Barack Obama wanted to bring the troops home, and that was a fiscally conservative thing to do. He's been trying to tell people that he's the most fiscally conservative candidate in the race.
There's a question I'm going to ask you that's being asked also in Kansas about which party the independent running there, Greg Orman, will side with if he's elected. What party does Larry Pressler side with should he be elected?
Well, just like Kansas, we don't know. The backstory, by the way, on Rick Wyland is that he got into this race and essentially forced out the person that the DSCC wanted, Harry Reid, and then in the party, the Senate Democrats wanted, and that was Stephanie Hursa-Salen. And Rick Wyland got into the race.
The former congresswoman,
right. She was sort of the hand-picked candidate. Well, Rick Wyland upset that by getting in the race, and Stephanie Hursa-Salen was like, I don't want to deal with a primary. So there's been a lot of animosity between Harry Reid and Rick Wyland, and then I guess publicly Tom Daschle, because Tom Daschle was supporting Rick Wyland. So a couple of weeks ago, Harry Reid was being quoted in papers saying South Dakota's a lost cause. We're not going to put money there. So so for the DSCC to now suddenly start putting money into the race, this is what you're looking for. What I'm looking for as observer here is. Is the DSCC money, are they running pro-Wyland spots, or are they just beating up on Mike Rounds? And so far, they've been just beating up on Mike Rounds. And the question is, are they just trying to soften up Mike Rounds enough to get, Larry Pressler over the top? Some people speculate that Larry Pressler, I mean, he's been in Washington, that he's made a deal that if this money can get him over the top, get him elected, that he would caucus with the Democrats.
President Obama's lost South Dakota both times he ran. Of course, that's not a surprise. But his numbers in the state are especially weak. Rounds is trying to link his two major opponents to the president. Let's listen.
Which candidate for the United States Senate best represents your values? Larry Pressler and Rick Wyland want to raise taxes. Mike Rounds will oppose Obama's tax plans. Pressler and Wyland support Obamacare. Mike Rounds will work to repeal it. Pressler and Wyland want more gun control. Mike Rounds is NRA endorsed and supports the Second Amendment. Only Mike Rounds will represent our values with his votes in the United States Senate.
Well, Rounds says he refuses to go negative. That sounds kind of negative, but does he really have a choice? I mean, does he need to go negative to win?
Well, you have to you have to have these contrast ads, and you know, you could say they're negative. I mean, that really was an emergency ad. I mean, that ad was just put together as soon as this race started to blow up last week. I mean, that ad was just rushed in to start to shore up Mike Rounds, and then you've started to see the NRSC come in with other ads. I mean, for the Republicans, it's, you know, it's a matter of having the cavalry arrive and basically save this campaign. But yeah, there really is no choice for the Republicans to really, you know, offer these contrasts, and that's the only way it's going to probably shore up Mike Rounds and even start to reverse some of the losses he's probably seen.
What are you going to be looking for in the final 2-3 weeks of the campaign?
The EB-5 thing, is there some shoe that's going to drop on that? I know I alluded to the fact that there were some criminal investigations. The state investigation wrapped up. There were no charges filed against anybody. The target of that investigation, Richard Bendit, committed suicide. But we do know there was a federal investigation, and we don't know what the status of that is. We haven't heard anybody, nobody will confirm for us. Interesting side note, the U.S. attorney in South Dakota is Brendan Johnson, the son of retiring Senator Tim Johnson. So that's an interesting side note. Is there going to be something that comes up out of that? Is the NRSC, which has basically had to come in and really, not only with advertising, but also just even trying to, you know, ramp up the get out the vote efforts, are they going to be able to reverse this and start to bring those numbers back up for Mike Rounds?
Jonathan Ellis is a reporter for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. He can be found on Twitter at Argus J. Ellis. Jonathan, thanks a lot for being on the Political Junkie.
Thanks a lot, Ken.
When we talk about states that we've been ignoring this year, Idaho has to be atop of the list. A very red state. Hasn't elected a Democratic governor since 1990. Or, in fact, a Democratic senator since 1974. Still, Democrats claim Butch Otter, the Republican governor, may be in trouble. One Democratic-leaning poll showed his battle with Democrat A.J. Belukoff within just a few points. Larry LaRocco, a former Democratic congressman, insists the state is changing. Congressman LaRocco, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks a lot, Ken. It's great to be with you.
Now, I received a note from you last month that said, and I hope I'm not violating a little private conversation here, but you said, Idaho is the most underreported state of this election cycle. Governor Otter is going to lose. Do you stand by that?
I do. And I'll hit on both points. If you were to ask anybody in America that follows politics what's going to happen in Idaho, they'd say the status quo. It's the reddest state in the country. There's nothing going on there. You don't even need to take a look at it. And now we see that there's a GOP civil war going on that's been really sponsored by the Tea Party. And you have a governor like Butch Otter, who just barely won his primary back in May. And he's a former congressman. He held the seat that I held, and he lost in that congressional district. He got the lowest percentage of any Republican governor running for reelection. He lost in the three largest counties in the state. And with the civil war going on between the establishment Republicans and the Tea Party, that leads me to believe that a lot of people are going to stay home because the wounds have not healed, Ken, here in Idaho, among the Republicans, and that gives an opportunity for A.J. Belukoff.
Now, Mike Simpson, who's the congressman from the other district, he was also challenged by the Tea Party, and he won pretty big. So why did Simpson do so well in the primary and Otter not so well?
Well, Otter's had some problems. He really has not had much vision as a governor, and he's tied to a failing education system in Idaho, which is really the key issue here. This issue is not about Obama. This issue isn't about health care, or it's not about foreign policy. This is about education and local issues. And let me tell you about what happened in 2012, just a couple of years ago. There were three education laws that were passed by the Republican-controlled legislature. And they were on a referendum on the ballot in 2012, and they lost in Idaho, each of them, by more than 15%, and they were voted on individually. Otter was very aligned with those education policies that were rejected. So now you just fast forward 2 years, and A.G. Belukov has made education his major issue here in the state. And I think that that is carrying forward. Plus, you have the addition of the Tea Party that it will probably stay home because they simply don't like Otter. And or they will go to a down-ballot candidate, the Constitutional Party or the Libertarian candidate.
Is Belukov a very good candidate, or do you see it more of an anti-Otter kind of referendum?
You know, he started slow, but he is a fast learner. I mean, I've been in politics for many years, Ken, and I always watch people come off the sidelines and run for office. And he is a quick learner. And last night there was a debate between him and Otter where he held his own. His rebuttals were strong. His message was clear. His narrative was strong. His attack was well measured and well thought out. Now, there are a couple factors here that play into this belief that I have that there's going to be an upset here. A.J. Belukov is a newcomer. He's a businessman. He doesn't have a political record. He's a moderate Democrat, and he's Mormon, LDS, and he voted for Romney. So you take Obama out of the equation, and he can appeal to the middle in Idaho, which is growing. He's also very wealthy. And he's raised a lot of money, but he has also put a lot of his own money into the campaign. So he continues to have arrows in his quiver in terms of fighting off the attacks that are coming at him. And that's one thing that I want to mention is that the Republican Governors Association in this red state of Idaho has come in and attacked Belukov with two types of ads that they're running. And they've spent over $200,000 in Idaho. Now, you know, we're political junkies, so you have to ask yourself, why would they be spending $200,000 to protect a Republican governor in a red state? So I think they see the same thing that I see, and it's getting pretty exciting coming down the home stretch.
Once upon a time, and it really wasn't that long ago, but Democrats had won 6 governor elections in a row in Idaho, and that came to an end in 1994. Why did that end?
Well, in 1994, there was a huge influx of people into the state of Idaho. So the state was changing dramatically. And also, I lost in 1994. It was a big sweep that year. And when I won in 1990, the state Senate was 21-21, evenly divided. As a matter of fact, Richard Stallings and I were the two members of the House of Representatives out of two. So the Democrats held 100% of the seats in Congress and the House of Representatives. It was a more moderate state at that time, and it was a more traditional Idaho's political environment where there was a large swath of independents in the middle. With the huge influx that we had after 95, there were a lot of Christian fundamentalists that moved into the state. Quite frankly, the Democrats went to sleep for a while, and we just sort of conceded a lot of races in that period. Now, a couple things have happened. I want to give a lot of credit to Howard Dean and the 50-state strategy that he started a number of years ago, because I think if you start with that and then you fast forward to the education laws that were defeated in 2012, and you look at the candidates that we have running for statewide office this time, you see a very strong bench with a lot of very strong campaign-savvy managers.
You used to work for Frank Church. Now, of course, for many people who listen to this program, they may not remember Frank Church. Tell us a little bit about him, and tell us, in this Democratic bench you talk about, whether there's another Frank Church to be found.
Well, I think there could be. He was a very unique individual. I had the distinct privilege of working for him for 6 years as his North Idaho field representative from 1975 to 1981. He really gave me my start in politics. He was my mentor. And when I represented him in Idaho, it was half of the first congressional district, so I got my start being his eyes and ears. But he was a great intellect, great visionary, and a very brave man with a great sense of humor and the highest ethics. I'm on the board of the Frank Church Institute at Boise State University, and next Sunday and Monday we're going to commemorate the anniversary of the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, which Frank Church managed. So he's known for many things, foreign policy. He's known for his investigation of the CIA. But a lot of people don't know the legacy that he has in natural resources. And I was on the floor of the Senate with him as his staffer in 1980 when we passed the River of No Return Wilderness in the state of Idaho, which is now known as the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness, thanks to the good work of Senator James McClure. And that legacy is so profound because it's not like he has a building named after him. He has a wilderness named after him.
You ran for lieutenant governor in 2006 and you ran for the Senate in 2008. Are your campaigning days behind you?
They are. They are definitely behind me. I'm strictly an observer and I fit into your political junkie category now. I'm still a strong Democrat. I love the state of Idaho. And I'm hopeful for more balance in the future. But I'm on the sidelines, and I ran seven times in Idaho, and it's very tough as a Democrat. I was very fortunate to be one of 11,000 Americans that have served in the Congress of the United States. And I'm very active with the United States Association of Former Members of Congress. I speak to school kids and college students whenever I can about public service and the value of serving as a public servant and helping to explain government and the Congress. And that's sort of my role right now in being a grandfather.
Larry LaRocca was a former two-term Democratic member of Congress from Idaho's 1st District, serving from 1991 until 1994 when he was defeated in the big GOP wave. Congressman, it was great to have you on the show.
Ken, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure to be with you, and we'll see what happens in just three short weeks. It's pretty exciting out here in Idaho, and thanks for taking a look at us.
Thanks so much. It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was: Arkansas Senator Mark Pryor is thought to be in trouble in his bid for a third term this year. 6 years ago, he was reelected without any major party opposition. Who was the last senator who went from running unopposed to getting defeated in the subsequent election? The answer is Dick Lugar. He had no Democratic Party opposition in 2006, but in 2012, he lost a Republican primary to Richard Murdoch in his bid for a seventh term. And the winner is Judy Keim of Westchester, Ohio. Judy wins the coveted political junkie button. And because of the holiday this week, and the fact that so many people are still stumped by last week's scuttle button puzzle, we've decided to keep the contest open for one more week. It's really a good one. I just don't want you to give up on it. As always, check out our website for the latest scuttle button puzzle. It's at krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's time for This Week in Political History. Politics can be exhilarating. It can be infuriating. Battling over issues and ideology is part of the system. But we never expect things like this.
A plane believed to be carrying Governor Mel Carnahan, his son Roger, and senior campaign advisor Chris Sifford went down in Jefferson County.
We heard a large explosion which shook our patio doors.
And the whole house just shook.
There were no survivors.
It was on This Week in 2000 when Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan, the Democratic nominee to take on Senator John Ashcroft, perished in a plane crash that also took the lives of his older son Randy and his closest campaign aide. Joe Manis is a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio, but at the time she was with St. Louis Post-Dispatch. She had been with Governor Carnahan the night before in Kansas City. And she remembers where she was when she heard the news. Joe, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for asking me.
Tell us about that awful day and how you heard the news.
Well, I had driven back from Kansas City to St. Louis that Monday morning because there was a whole bunch of stuff going on because we were hosting the presidential debate at Washington University on Tuesday. So many of us were doing double duty. I had been traveling with Ashcroft, who Carnahan was challenging, and Carnahan covering their campaign, but we were kind of shifting gears for the presidential race. And I had just finished a meeting, had gone home about 8 o'clock that night, and one of the editors then called me and said that on the scanner they heard that Randy's plane had gone down, Randy Carnahan. He said it was a plane registered to Randy Carnahan, and my heart just stopped. And I said, if it's Randy's plane, the governor's on it. And he said, are you sure? And I said, no question, because Randy had been flying him around. In fact, they had flown to Kansas City and all over the place. They had a small plane. So then I called their campaign manager on his cell phone, and he was hysterical. And before I even said anything, it was the most heart-wrenching telephone conversation I've ever had in my life.
It had to be an unspeakably emotional time.
Yes, because when you cover candidates, and I'd covered Mel Carnahan off and on for over a decade, I mean, you're neutral, but you know these people. It's just like I knew John Ashcroft. You know, I've known him for just as long. And so you know these people, and it's just so stunning. I'd never had a candidate die during a campaign.
It was also just a day later. It was the third and final debate between Vice President Al Gore and Texas Governor George W. Bush took place, and that was in St. Louis. This is how moderator Jim Lehrer began the debate.
Before proceeding tonight, we would like to observe a moment of silence in memory of Governor Mel Carnahan of Missouri, who, along with his son and his former chief of staff, died in a private plane crash last night near St. Louis.
And then President Clinton delivered one of the many eulogies at the funeral. Let's listen to some of that.
I love the guy. And anybody who thinks he was dull never looked him straight in the eye. Because he had steel and passion and fire. And I think he rather enjoyed being underestimated by people who disagreed with him.
Were you at the funeral?
Yes. In fact, I was traveling with President Clinton that day. So actually, I was sitting behind him on a step just a few feet away when he delivered those lines. And I'll never forget that first line that he gave because it was interesting. One of the reasons Clinton said that was because when Clinton was running for president in 1992, Mel Carnahan, who was then lieutenant governor, endorsed him early on when Clinton was in the midst of these controversies over various women who were coming out saying that they'd had relationships with him. And Clinton never forgot that. Streets were packed. Jefferson City is a small town for state capital, and it was packed. And as far as your eye could see, there was people. There was tens of thousands packing the streets for the funeral.
Tell me, what kind of a governor, what kind of a man was Mel Carnahan?
He was one of the more interesting people who I'd covered. Again, I'd covered him for about at least a decade. I traveled with him many times. I had been to his farm that he had in Rolla. He was a tall guy, angular, somewhat quiet. He was not mesmerizing on the stump at all, but he was very shrewd, didn't suffer fools lightly. He had guts on some things. For example, in the 90s, Missouri is a conservative state on social issues, including abortion. But Carnahan had been supporting of reproductive rights regardless and started a family planning program where some state money was used to pay for family planning. That was very controversial, and he fought numerous efforts by conservatives to get rid of it. That was the kind of thing that it was a fight he didn't have to have, but he did. He got through a tax increase early on in his governorship to pay for increased education spending. I mean, he's one of the few politicians I covered who actually campaigned promising to raise taxes, and he won anyway. He was very disciplined. He always made sure he got plenty of sleep at night. That was one thing I knew about him. When he was home on the farm on weekends, he would do his own grocery shopping. And the security people, it killed him because he didn't want them walking through the grocery store with him. And it was the grocery store clerks who confirmed that that's what he would do on Saturday mornings. But I actually went to the store with him one time, And I thought maybe he was just doing it because I was doing a profile on him. So I went, I wandered off and was talking to some of the clerks, and they were telling me that he always came in solo, usually sat early Saturday morning. And that's what he did. The security people would be outside. And then after I got all that, actually his campaign manager asked me to be very general about it because they didn't want people to know that he did that. Because, you know, he was the governor. He did have death threats against him, especially because of things over the abortion issue.
So you have a Democratic Party, you have the state and the Democratic Party in shock, and but yet you have an election coming up in 3 weeks. Carnahan's name was going to stay on the ballot.
Right.
What did the Democratic Party do?
Well, what they figured out they could do was tell people that if they voted for Mel Carnahan, his widow, Jean Carnahan, would be appointed to the seat. That was what they settled on. It took about several days to kind of settle on that. The Republicans were contending that that might be illegal. The Republicans were getting very vocal about whether or not Democrats could mention any name. All that got shut down when former Senator Tom Eagleton held a press conference at his St. Louis law office and basically shouted that he was referring to John Ashcroft. He said, if Ashcroft can't defeat a dead man, he doesn't deserve to be in the U.S. Senate. And that shut everything down.
That whole thing put Ashcroft in a very uncomfortable position, because how do you campaign and who is he running against? He's not running against a deceased governor. I mean, it must have been very difficult for him.
It was. In fact, I covered his first events that he held after the funeral. Ashcroft did not campaign during the week right after the death while they were doing the funeral preparations and that sort of thing. Ashcroft didn't do anything. So he waited till after the funerals before he went back on the campaign trail. And I was with him. And he told me, he said he wasn't sure who he was running against. They were running against a ghost.
So despite the fact that he was no longer with us, Mel Carnahan won that election. I mean, he was gone, but he won.
Yes. There was kind of this groundswell. Robin had settled on this slogan, don't let the fire go out. Jean Carnahan actually didn't campaign. The Carnahan family and the Democratic Party tried to be very careful how they dealt with this, because they didn't want to look like they were taking advantage of the situation. And I'll never forget, there was a big rally that Al Gore flew into town for a rally on Monday, the day before the election. And at that point, the presidential contest was seesawing in Missouri. And Bob Holden, who was running for governor, he was the gubernatorial nominee. His plane was late. And I'll never forget the stage. Everybody on the stage, because the whole statewide ticket was on the stage except for Holden. And they were scared to death because it was raining outside. The circumstances were so similar to what had happened just a few weeks before. And then when he showed up late, the whole crowd just stood on their feet just because Holden walked in. And it was that kind of thing. It was very emotional.
Remind us of your last conversation with Mel Carnahan.
Yes. And this kind of gets to him. One of the things I liked about him was that he was extremely candid. And this was after the debate in Kansas City on public television on that Sunday night. And I had covered Ashcroft's comments first, and then I ran to Carnahan's. And when I walked in, he had finished his little press conference already, and he had his water bottle. It says he's a very healthy guy. I'll never forget, he was waving his water bottle at me, and he goes, "There you are." And I explained that I'd done Ashcroft first because I had done Carnahan first after his last debate.
Fair is fair,
and right, I was trying to be fair. So then Carnahan gets in this whole thing about this article that had been in the Sunday Post-Dispatch that day about Social Security and his objections to certain facts that he believed had been misrepresented in the story. Now, I didn't write the story, but it had been a really long, one of those really long stories. And I remember standing there thinking, he had a debate tonight, and he was on his plane today reading that story that had nothing to do with his race. I just remember standing there, and I just kind of had a little – it was classic Carnahan. It was just classic, you know, and I just had the smile, a little bit of a smile on my face, and he kind of chuckled too, and he said, well, you just tell him – he told me who the reporter, he told me to send him a message to say – got that part of the story wrong. And that was the last conversation I had.
Joe Manis is a political reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. For decades, she was the chief political reporter with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and had long covered Carnahan. You can follow her on Twitter at jmanis, M-A-N-N-I-E-S. Joe, thanks for sharing your memories with us.
Well, thank you so much for asking me.
It was on This Week in 2000 that Mel Carnahan, the governor of Missouri who was running for the Senate, died in a plane crash, along with his older son and his chief of staff. He would go on to be posthumously elected to the Senate. Never happened before. It has not happened since. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. On the ballot next month will be contests for 36 Senate seats, all 435 seats in the House, and 36 races for governor. But there's also a campaign for mayor of Providence, Rhode Island, going on as well that's attracting attention. That's where Buddy Cianci served some 21 years as mayor before being sent to prison on corruption charges. Now the 73-year-old Cianci wants his old job back, and not everyone is happy about that. Mike Stanton is an associate professor of journalism at the University of Connecticut and the author of The Prince of Providence, The Rise and Fall of Buddy Cianci, America's Most Notorious Mayor. Mike, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken. Nice to be with you.
I know we got you in the middle of a very busy day. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure.
Well, what can I say? He's back.
Buddy's back. We had Buddy one in the 1970s when he was the anti-corruption candidate. And then we had Buddy two when he came back in the 1990s after being forced to resign for a felony assault conviction in which he used his police bodyguard to hold a man prisoner in his house who he suspected of having an affair with his estranged wife. And now Buddy went away about 12 years ago for a racketeering conspiracy, and now he's attempting at the age of 73 and after having beaten cancer to come back for a third time. And it's really captured a lot of people's attention, both people who love and adore him and people who despise and fear him. And we've got a lot of both.
Mike, when you mentioned, you were talking about the assault on his estranged wife's suspected lover, you didn't mention that he assaulted him with a lit cigarette.
Well, there's a lot of layers of complexity to the Buddy Cianci story. And even, you know, those situations, there's layers. Yes, I mean, he punched him. He threw, a drink in his face. At one point, he tried to jab a lit cigarette in his eye, and the man flinched and it singed his eyebrow. He also famously threw an ashtray at him. The ashtray missed. And he tried to club him with a fireplace log, but an associate held him back, so it never connected, thankfully.
I guess we've just uncovered further proof that cigarettes can be dangerous.
Dangerous to your health. Well, you know, Buddy, I remember during his racketeering trial, he used to sit on the courthouse steps during breaks, and, you know, the reporters would hang out with him, and he'd tell his stories, and I remember he would smoke cigarettes, and he would always fret that the camera was going to, you know, capture him smoking, and, you know, this would make him look bad. But he said, but, you know, every time I smoke, it helps school children because there's a tax on cigarettes, and that goes to education. So I kind of described it as Buddy repackaging vice as virtue.
Well, but it's fair to say he was a popular mayor, wasn't he? I mean, and he did some good things for the city.
He did. I mean, he's tremendously charismatic. He's a relentless campaigner. He'll show up at the proverbial opening of an envelope. I remember being a young reporter at the Providence Journal, and another reporter has a backyard barbecue on the east side of Providence, and Buddy pulls up in his chauffeured, police limousine and, you know, sits with us around the campfire, you know, past midnight. But he's got that charisma. I ran into him, you know, last month, and he said, I'm going to win because all these voters who are now voting in Providence were kids when I was mayor last time, and I went to all their Little League games, so they remember me fondly.
Well, some of them probably still do remember him fondly, but some are also embarrassed about what this says about Providence, should he win.
Yes, I mean, there are people who fear that it will make Providence a laughingstock, enforce our image for corruption, and make it harder to attract businesses and jobs to help turn around Rhode Island's stagnant economy.
Well, he's running as an independent. What's his campaign platform?
His campaign platform is leadership and experience. And we're going to raise Providence's self-esteem as I did before. And we're going to bring it back to be the great city that it was when, You know, Buddy will say, I moved rivers, I built a shopping mall, I brought in Waterfire, which is this great tourist attraction. And, you know, he'll go on and on. And he was a great cheerleader for the city. He would bring a lot of attention to the city. He championed, you know, cultural events that put us on the map. Things that really, there was a very dramatic construction project that unfolded over several years where they moved rivers that had been covered over and paved over. And it really did improve the downtown landscape tremendously. Now, obviously, this was a much larger project than Buddy. He wasn't Moses moving the river single-handedly. He was more of a cheerleader who supported it, and it was done with federal money and a lot of state control as well.
There was an interesting news conference on Tuesday in which of three former federal prosecutors,
yes,
including Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, now Senator Whitehouse,
yes,
they warned the city against returning him to office. What effect do you think that has on the voters?
Well, I mean, it depends on which camp you're in. If you're in the camp that thinks Buddy's the savior, you kind of dismiss it as it's, you know, as Buddy called it, it's the elites out to get me, you know, without any real, you know, thoughtful analysis. Well, why are they out to get you, Buddy? Why are they so, you know, determined that they don't think it would be good for you to get back in? On the other hand, you know, there are people who it will give pause. There's about 20% of the electorate in the most recent poll 2 weeks ago are undecided, and a significant portion of them are concerned about Buddy's criminal past. And it's not just the two felony convictions, because he'll try to dismiss those as, you know, the assault was a domestic matter, a peak of passion, the racketeering conspiracy, they got me on one count, but I never took a dime. The other counts, you know, I was not convicted of. But the flip side of that is that there were 30 people in his two administrations who were convicted, and many of whom went to prison, including some of his closest aides.
The Democratic candidate is Jorge Elorza. Tell us about him.
Jorge Elorza is a first-time candidate. He's about 36 years old. He's a law professor and former housing court judge in Providence. And he was, you know, he has kind of this, you know, Horatio Alger story. You know, he grew up poor in, you know, in a, you know, poorer section of the city. You know, his parents were Guatemalan immigrants. He was rejected from every college he applied to out of high school because he goofed off. He came forward and admitted that he'd been arrested for shoplifting as a teenager. But then he turned his life around through education, and he wound up graduating from Harvard Law School. And now he's running, and he's kind of, you know, it's kind of the fresh-faced guy versus the grizzly veteran. And I think Elorza is helped somewhat by the certainly there's a lot of people who don't think Buddy should come back, so he's got their votes. And he's also helped by the fact that the city has about 38% of its population is Latino. Now, that's not a slam dunk for him. I mean, Latino is not a monolithic vote. You've got Dominicans, Guatemalans, a lot of different groups. And Buddy does have some roots with those communities from his years of campaigning there. But that's where the battle is really being waged in this election. And so far, Elorza has held his own in debates because Buddy is a master debater, and people worried about, you know, Jorge's supporters worried how he would stand up to that.
Cianci could win, couldn't he?
He could. I mean, the latest poll had him up 38% to 32% with 21% undecided. There's a third candidate in the race, the Republican Dan Harrop, who's polling at about 5 or 6% of the vote.
And what would that say about Providence, or what would it say about our love affair with rogues?
Well, I would say that the great American tradition of rogues, going back to Boss Tweed and Huey Long and James Michael Curley and Edwin Edwards, is still alive and well. That there's this kind of cynical view of politics that corruption is part of the process, and so you might as well go with a guy who gets things done, or the perception that he gets things done. The optimistic view would be, you know, his story, you know, his version, which is this is all about redemption and, you know, coming back and finishing the job that he started.
Mike Stanton is the author of The Prince of Providence, The Rise and Fall of Buddy Cianci, America's Most Notorious Mayor. Mike, thanks for being on the show.
It's great to be with you.
That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. If you've got comments, questions, or the fact that I still haven't sent you your Political Junkie button, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Or tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie. Or shoot us a message on Facebook. Just search for The Political Junkie. And have you checked out the button of the day? You can find it on Instagram at The Political Junkie, as well as on our website. And with the elections quickly approaching, you must enter our 2014 midterms prediction contest. All at krpoliticaljunkie.com. Our producer and editor is A.D. Quigg. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and webmaster. Kristen Sorensen is our consultant. And Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.